Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast brought to you by the magazine that is totally doing a webathon starting right the hell tomorrow, or even today if you're listening to this on Tuesday. I'm going to talk about this all in a second after we introduce myself and everybody else on this podcast. What am I even doing? Why am I alive? I am Matt Welch, joined by Nicholas B. Peter Suderman and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Cyber Monday, if that is indeed what holiday we are celebrating.
Howdy, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
The happiest thing about Cyber Monday is that you're allowed to say cyber.
That's true.
You're allowed. Who right? is going to stop you? Don't
Have
ask permission.
Seen, there's a whole website. That's like basically...
We talk about this every year.
There's a whole website and it's just a questionnaire that determines whether or not and under what circumstances it's okay to use the prefix cyber.
Today.
Yeah. Today's
the whole
website.
And it's basically today and every day if you're William Gibson.
I think that you should talk about this for another 5 minutes. Yeah. But instead of that, we're going to talk a little bit about the webathon. Mm. So for all of you out there, friends, loved ones, frenemies, haters, and losers, your magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets is kicking off its 17th annual week-long fundraising
Almost
webathon thingy.
Almost old enough to buy cigarettes.
Tomorrow. Vapes, pretty easy to get. We try... to during this week persuade you ever so gently to think about making a contribution, tax deductible, of course, to the 501c3 Reason Foundation nonprofit that makes all of our work possible. By work, I do mean journalism and commentary and the Remy videos and the awesome Abolish Everything covers and hopefully swag and then special events and of course podcast and also our first ever Reason versus debate series in Washington DC on December 18th, which we'll talk about later too. Last year when we did the webathon, we got 1,275 of you magnificent beauties to donate a record shattering $725,000. That's a lot of money. We used that immediately to buy a couple of Hunter Biden NFTs. That's a joke. Well, we didn't actually do that. We did lots and more better stuff, including new lines of product and whatnot. We'll be talking about that for the next week. This year, our fundraising target is a very modest 400,000 simoleons. Surely we can climb that peak together. Your immediate call to action for those of you listening and watching at home is to not mash the donate button just yet. Again, that starts tomorrow morning, Tuesday morning, but rather send your emails to us right the hell now for a special bonus webathon Ask Us Anything episode that we're taping on Wednesday. So roundtable@reason.com. You can stump us individually. It could be personal. It can be broad. It could be anything. Just send us lots of questions. We are going to fill the time answering them. Now, Catherine, can you please open up the curtain over there and show listeners what bangs they can receive for their bucks this year?
I love to be a Vanna White for you, Matt. So behind door number one, we have for $50 donors, the Reason Plus subscription. This means you get ad-free browsing. It means you get early access to the magazine. It means you get commenting privileges and some special events, sometimes with the very people on this podcast. $100 gets you all those things. And one of those little wallets that you stick on the back of your phone, you know what I mean? Those are really handy. I like those a lot. $250 gets you all that stuff and an Abolish Everything t-shirt because you want to pick fights on the subway. $500 gets you all those things and a cozy Reason branded blanket because it's cold today. $1,000 gets you all of those things plus an invitation to Reason Weekend, a torchbearer pin, and a shout out on this podcast. It's Exact Nature TBD. $5,000 gets you all those things plus lunch with an editor in Washington, D.C., or your moment of fame as a donor of the week on the podcast. If you choose to do lunch with an editor in Washington, D.C., it should be me. I am the best person to have lunch with. Lunch is great with me. $10,000 gets you all of those things, plus a ticket to Reason Weekend for first-time employees, first-time attendees, maybe also first-time employees. You get a job at Reason. If
do
you donate $10,000, we just hire you. So that's what we're doing. You also get a tax break because that is very on brand for us. You should give us your money and we'll give you cool stuff and also the satisfaction of knowing that you supported your favorite magazine.
Thank you, Vanna Mangu Ward. Let's get back to our regular scheduled programming. On Sunday night, President Joseph Robinette Biden the second can't even pronounce his name anymore. I've forgotten so much who he is.
Neither can he. Jinx. So you're in good company.
Yes. He dropped some legacy bombs Sunday night by issuing a blanket pardon to his fail son, Hunter, covering all of the ex-crackhead's possibly criminal activities, beginning back to the beginning of the year of our Lord 2014, which, fun fact, is the same year that he accepted a grotesquely lucrative job with the Ukrainian oil company Burisma while his father was vice president and had Ukraine as part of his responsibilities. I can't believe all of that happened, but that's just the world that we live in. Hunter had previously this year pleaded guilty to tax fraud, failing to pay millions of dollars worth of taxes, and also for lying about his drug use when applying to buy a gun. I thought this was America.gif. Said our doddering president, quote, "From the day I took office, I said I would not interfere with the Justice Department's decision making, and I kept my word." Even as I watched my son being selectively and unfairly prosecuted. Also, quote, "No reasonable person who looks at the facts of Hunter's cases can reach any other conclusion than Hunter was singled out only because he is my son. And that is wrong." Among those unconvinced by these arguments were the libertarian leading Democrat governor of Colorado, Jared Polis, who tweeted, quote, "I am disappointed that he put his family ahead of the country. This is a bad precedent that could be abused by later presidents and will sadly tarnish his reputation." And then also Reason's own Robbie Suave, who wrote this morning that he has issued what may well be remembered as the most disreputable presidential pardon in U.S. history. Nick, is Robbie being an excitable boy? Or does this one really, really stink?
It, without putting it on a a timeline of how stinky it is, this is a Limburger cheese of a presidential pardon, Matt Welch. It is unbelievably, I have a three-pronged critique, none of which involves Star Wars, the Marvel Extended Universe, or DC film, so we can rest easy for the next couple minutes. But first off,
it's like a pitchfork, the well-known music magazine.
Unbelievably hypocritical. There is a great super cut out from Tom Elliott. We'll link to it in the show notes, which is just dozens of examples of Biden swearing that he is never going to pardon Hunter or anything like that, and a bunch of fawning media yaks yes, you're so honorable. Which reminds us not only for the content, which is great on this particular moment, but that the supercut is like the native form of a DIY, postmodern media landscape where you can just reassemble found pieces into something super fantastic and great. But it's totally hypocritical. It's also totally understandable. I think any of us who are parents here would have done something similar to get the fucking kid off, so in that sense, from a human point of view, you can stop for a moment and empathize, even though Hunter still isn't like paying back, the taxes or anything like that. Like, he should be making amends. He's in, 1,000 12-step programs. All of them have some aspect about making amends. And it's curious that neither Joe Biden nor Hunter Biden seem to have done anything like that, unless, selling your paintings for tens of thousands of dollars, is an act of amends. I mean, he should be destroying them, possibly with the gun that he bought illegally. That would be nice. That would be a good art project, wouldn't it? And then most importantly, this is unbelievably awful. And this is, shoots through Robbie's piece, but through everybody, including people who support Joe Biden. We are in a free fall, landscape of, where nobody trusts or believes the government to do the right thing anymore. And, the president had been slumping. Congress is already in single digits. Even the courts are going downhill. This is such a slap in the face. I mean, Joe Biden couldn't have humiliated, the American public more than by pulling his pants down when he's walking out of the presidential helicopter or using a walker or whatever. This is such an insult to anything that comes close to believing and trusting that the government will do something according to the law rather than according to the needs and desires and whims of the people who run it. In that way, it may be a fitting, you know, final public act for somebody like Joe Biden before Trump comes in. And it actually tees up Trump not to do more of the same, but to say, you know what, like, that is appalling. And I am actually going to run my second term in stark contrast to Joe Biden rather than as a continuation of this horrible, egregious, you know, self-interested act that is really, you know, Biden was already in the bottom five presidents. This is going to take him past that. He's there until we have 100 presidents. He'll still be in the bottom of the five.
I'm taking the under on the Charles Kushner pardoning president. Taking the high road.
Ambassador Kushner.
Not yet.
Building on what Nick was saying, but not the pants part. This Biden passage stuck in my throat like a turkey bone. Quote, for my entire career, I have followed a simple principle. Just tell the American people the truth. They'll be fair-minded. End quote. Do you get any sense whatsoever, Peter, that your Democratic friends and neighbors there in Washington, D.C., have any sense of self-consciousness whatsoever that consistently lying all the damn time and then like wrapping it up as like, I'm totally doing all these cool things in the name of the truth is a little bit irritating?
No, I don't think they have that sense at all because I don't think they think they're lying. I think they have come up with reasons.
It's crazy.
In their head. They have they have justified all of the not quite truths and sort of, well, that's close enough to the truth. All of their horseshoe truths, right? Like it's close enough. You know, it didn't quite hit. This is what my band director always used to say is close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, right? Like they get they're like it's truthiness. It's close enough. And this is actually what's funny is that the idea of truthiness was initially an attack on Republicans who absolutely, you know, especially with regard to the Iraq war that came out of the kind of comic news presenter world. It wasn't The Daily Show, I believe, but it was the other guy who's now Colbert, who invented this. Right. And like that was liberals saw this as a stirring critique of the right and of the way that Republicans operated, you know, and of people like Bush. And I think that many of them would say that continues to be true with someone like Donald Trump, who is just clearly not burdened by the need to tell the truth. But they don't see that when they don't see it when they are doing it. They think they're doing something else. And they think that because they are serving honorable purposes and not intentionally lying for some sort of self-serving purpose, that's what they think in their head. I'm not saying that's what they're actually doing. They view it that way. And so they don't see it at all.
The Biden administration was notorious on this about, of course, Biden's own fitness, about the Robert Hur report about his own cognitive decline.
Sharp
and also
as
about
attack.
Stuff like about vaccine mandates. Right. And I know it's 1,000 years ago, so we've all forgotten. But the president elect said in December 2020, oh, we're not going to do that. And then the White House press person said, oh, we're not going to do that. And Michelle Walensky said, we're not going to do that. And then Biden said, sorry, look what you made.
Do you remember Obamacare and the central claim of Obamacare in selling it was, if you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan. Well, that turned out not to be true. And there was a Wall Street Journal report that I have cited a zillion times that almost everyone has forgotten about. In my recollection, I could be wrong about this, but it like ran on a Saturday. But there's a Wall Street Journal report that basically said that when Obama and his top economic and policy advisors were discussing how this plan would be set up, they knew that that was going to be not strictly true. They knew that it was not going to be true that everybody who liked their plan could keep their plan. And yet they also understood that in order to sell Obamacare, they had to say that because Hillary Care in the 1990s had failed largely because people thought they couldn't, not thought, people correctly understood that it would have taken away health insurance plans that they liked. And so they chose to tell something that was certainly you could characterize as a lie. It wasn't fully true, let's say. It was maybe a little bit misleading, perhaps even a lot misleading to people. They chose to tell a lie to sell a policy. And they justified this to themselves by saying, well, it's a good policy. That is what Republicans were doing with the Iraq War, and it didn't make it right in either case. And I think Democrats see this as, oh, you know, it's a good policy. That means you just, you have to market it. And marketing is always a little bit about, you know, it doesn't have to be strictly true. It has to be close enough to true. Well, this, all of this, the Iraq War, Obamacare, the pandemic, all of these lies, all of these shadings of the truth, all of these, you know, misleading statements where the people saying them knew that they weren't strictly true, all of that has served to degrade trust in government. And when Democrats complain about this stuff, they are just as much of a part of the problem as the Republicans were before Donald Trump.
Catherine, let's let you talk. I see a lot of reaction to this pardon. From people saying, you know, we really have to rein in that pardon power. This is just serial abuse and whatever. Doesn't Reason like pardons?
I do like the pardon power, and I think it's a valuable one for the presidency to possess. I think there are two things about the Hunter Biden pardon. One, no one should have been surprised because, one, we know that Biden lies, so he was lying about this. Two, the main thing we know about Joe Biden as a country is, like, he'll do anything for his sons. He talks about it all the time. He loves them so much.
Except raise them right.
But like, he telegraphed this a long way away. Third, the president's pardoning their family members tradition is long and disgusting. It begins maybe, I don't know, with Abraham Lincoln, who pardoned his wife's half-sister, who was the widow of a Confederate general. The deal of the pardon was, I will pardon you. You take an oath of loyalty to the United States. Did she take the oath? No. No, she did not. No, she didn't, Matt. Thanks for asking. So it's always like this. There are always like just garbage family members kind of lurking in the background that presidents pardon because it just seems easier and lol, nothing matters. And we are absolutely in the lol, nothing matters phase of the Biden presidency. I think we can all agree. This is going to make it harder to say Donald Trump is a bad norms breaker and Joe Biden is a perfect angel. But a lot of things, we're already making that harder.
Is garbage families lurking in the background our transition to a Thanksgiving segment?
Well, you know, there is a presidential brother of Joseph Robinette Biden II, Jr., Max, Matt, who will probably get a pardon as well.
I would imagine that he will. Well, let's talk about... since Reason is all about...
I'm sorry. It would have been great if Hunter, though, the cost of the pardon was that he had to show up with the turkeys being pardoned.
Oh, so yeah. It's like, actually just a triple
Mr.
A triple pardon.
Jaws, Hunter, and Tootsie, the turkey.
Only if he slid naked down the slide holding a turkey
brown
in each
sugar,
hand.
Brown sugar, maple syrup, and Hunter Biden, or whatever.
You know
the
he's got an
called.
Entry in his Venmo that's just gobble gobble.
Gross.
That's disgusting. All right, let's...
You've crossed the line, Peter. It's a Thanksgiving joke.
We're beyond that. It's December. We can start playing the she and him music. Let's talk about who we would pardon. Catherine, why don't you lead us off in a round of... We've got 50-some-odd days, I don't know, of this old man.
The advent there, calendar of Joseph Biden's conclusion.
The guy who like signed every war on drugs bill imaginable and wrote half of them, maybe he could do a few pardons on the way out the door. What would we suggest as things and people that he should pardon? Catherine, go.
So the two most popular presidential pardons are when Joe Biden pardoned people convicted of marijuana possession and former service members convicted of crimes related to their sexual orientation, and the pardoning of draft resistors from the Vietnam War by Ford and Carter. Those are really popular. I guess that was three. Those are really popular. I would do pardons in the same vein. And by the way, get to the conclusion that Biden wanted to get to anyway. Let's pardon people who did nonviolent firearms offenses. Let's do them all. If we're gonna let this one dude who did bad paperwork on his gun off, let's let everybody off. So that's my pick.
Peter Pardoner, who do you got?
So the president should pardon D.M. Bennett, who was convicted under the Comstock Act in 1879. Yes, this would be a posthumous pardon. But Dion Bennett was convicted under the Comstock Act, basically for publishing a pamphlet called Cupid's Yokes, which attacked the institution of marriage. It was written by a free love advocate named Ezra Haywood, who was also convicted under the Comstock Act, but was pardoned. But because Bennett was an enemy of Anthony Comstock, the enforcer of the Comstock Act, who was the guy who basically decided what was immoral and therefore what was illegal. And he did this, by the way, as an agent of the U.S. Postal Service, which is just, it's not okay. So because Bennett was somebody who opposed the Comstock Act, he was targeted by Anthony Comstock, who lobbied to make sure that he did not get pardoned. And so he was sentenced to a year in a labor camp, and he was already pretty elderly. Yes, this would be posthumous, like I said, and so in some ways it would be symbolic, but there's a great piece about this by Robert Korn Revere on our website over the summer, and he basically argues that this would send a signal of America's commitment to free thought and free expression. It would be a good and right thing to do in retrospect, and this is who he should pardon, is D.M. Bennett.
Nick, nominate a pardon.
I am going to nominate that the Silk Road founder, Ross Ulbricht, for at least a commutation of the rest of his life sentence for founding and operating the Silk Road website. People here probably know who Ross Ulbricht is, but with the Silk Road, he created a dark web or deep web drug marketplace that was incredibly effective and helpful in people being able to source and find drugs that are illegal or they weren't allowed to buy legally. And it also provided one of the early test cases for Bitcoin because it was operated with Bitcoin. Ross is a former Eagle Scout. He is a model citizen in almost every way. And as longtime readers of Reason will remember, when in his sentencing hearing, the judge went after him in such a way when I reported it at Reason, a bunch of commenters who expressed their anger and disgust with the judge ended up being, investigated by the federal government as a result of their anger. Ross Ulbricht deserves to be pardoned. Donald Trump, to his credit, at the Libertarian Party convention, said he would pardon Ross Ulbricht or commute his sentence early on. There's a hashtag Free Ross Day One. Joe Biden should do this because Ross Ulbricht is kind of the inverse of Hunter Biden. He is somebody who has committed crimes, been convicted of crimes that have to do with drugs and whatnot. Bring him out, Joe Biden. Steal Donald Trump's thunder and make the world a little bit better. Ross Ulbricht has been serving since 2015. He has been in jail longer than some of the investigators who went after him were, of course, convicted of stealing Bitcoin and other types of things. They're all out. Ross Ulbricht deserves to be pardoned and certainly, if not pardoned, then commuted.
We'll also say, while keeping my own fingers crossed, and all of our fingers crossed that that happens, that also Donald Trump at the same convention promised to nominate a libertarian to his cabinet, which he has not so far. Speaking of criminal justice, President-elect Donald Trump last week nominated to be his FBI director, Kash Patel. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but it's an awesome name. A staunch loyalist, as he's always described, it's by law, and critic of the deep state, who served in the previous Trump administration as Department of Defense Chief of Staff, as Deputy Director of National Intelligence, and Senior Director for Counterterrorism at the National Security Council. As part of nominating him, the idea is that he's vacating the final 3 years of the FBI directorship of Christopher Wray, who Trump appointed back in 2017. The idea is that FBI directors would serve 10-year terms, so they're kind of not as directly related to presidential power and whatnot. Catherine, what do we think about first, Trump firing Christopher Wray? I've seen the David Frums of the world describe this literally as worse than Watergate, an idea that we're now politicizing the the criminal justice federal system in this term. What do you think about it?
I guess I don't have strong opinions about the Ray thing. This feels like yet another front in the Manorms battle. I have mixed feelings about that battle. I would like for people to observe those types of norms. They exist for good reasons. On the other hand, Ray kind of sucked, so I'm not sorry to see him go. Kash Patel also seems like he kind of sucks, but let's talk about the things that are good first, I guess. I think a lot of what he says about the deep state, maybe we should pause and have like a deep state moment here. I prefer the term administrative state because that's the problem, right? For the most part, it's the members of the unelected bureaucracy, which is the group that he says he would go after in his 2023 book, Government Gangsters. Unfortunately, when people say the deep state, they often get a little too expansive for my taste, and they start to lump in, I don't know, journalists, people who own large tech companies that happen to provide platforms for speech, that kind of thing. I think it's really, really important to hold the line, and Kash Patel has made it super clear that he does not see that line. So while I like, hey, let's roll back FBI overreach, let's roll back the sort of FISA court, rubber stamping, all that sounds good to me. I do not enjoy being considered a part of the deep state because I am super not.
I just want to point out that Kash Patel is a co-author of a children's book and I think even a book series called The Plot Against
it's
the
a
King,
trilogy.
Which I'm going to hold up.
It's a trilogy. There are three.
The cover to here yeah. As a picture of Donald Trump. I presume that's like Nancy Pelosi is some kind of evil.
It tells the story of Hillary
yeah. Clinton yes. And her shifty knight who spreads the lies
no,
that
not.
King Donald has cheated to become king.
He also sometimes signs the same kind of like Kesha used to for a while
with a dollar sign. I like
yeah.
that.
Which I like that. Yeah, it's very Randian, just like Kesha.
Peter, what do we think about not just his children's book stylings, but the possible worryingness of his previous recent statements, including on Steve Bannon's podcast, that he's going to install a team of all-American patriots that are going to come after members of the press that have lied about American citizens and helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you, whether it's criminal or civilly. We'll figure that out. Is that?
Oh, that's cool? Reassuring. When the guy who's been appointed to the FBI to like run the FBI is like, we're going to go after the journalists. Yeah, that's free speech is back, baby.
Nick, mm-hmm. Is there some argument to be made that someone who either colors outside the lines or just no. really draws Hillary Clinton
self-publishes his own children's books? Yes. Yes, Matt, there is. There is an absolute case to be made for this type of pick from Donald Trump, and I'm ready to make
Let's hear it.
First, I want to point out that the FBI director serves at the discretion of the president, so there is nothing constitutional. There's nothing Watergate-y about Trump firing Christopher Wray and putting in his nomination, his appointee, who's going to have to see muster, from the Senate, assuming that big bunch of lumber, gets its shit together at any point in time. Patel is, he represents, like RFK Jr. and a bunch of other Trump picks, like he has said he wants to destroy the FBI and the surveillance state. And would that be a bad thing? No. It would be a messy thing and it might not yield better results. Like after the field is burned and whatever starts growing in it afterwards might be just as bad or worse, especially when you get this, vindictiveness that comes across in a lot of his statements. But he's also talked about declassifying massive amounts of documents that the government is holding. Good for him. Let's do that. He talked about having a 24/7 kind of declassification regime where everything is coming out from the past as well as the present. More power to him for that kind of stuff. When we're talking about the deep state, and I think particularly, there is the administrative state and a bureaucracy that takes on an energy of its own when we're talking about implementing certain kinds of environmental policy, certain kinds of trade policies, things like that, including, the things that the Trump administration, he promised to deconstruct the administrative state, and he did not. And one of the Supreme Court rulings that reeled in the administrative state was actually against a rule one of his administrators propounded. So it's like, good, you know, Trump is eating his own tail. Who knows about that? But the deep state and the intelligence state is something different. This, you know, it really refers to the security apparatus and the military. And we know from Trump 1.0 that the, you know, people in the defense world, people in the State Department, you know, lied to Trump about the number of troops that were overseas in places like Syria and Iraq and stuff like that. That needs not to be deconstructed. That needs to be blown up, and we need to start over. I don't necessarily have a lot of faith in Kash Patel for doing all of this, but this is the promise that Trump brought first time around and didn't deliver on. I'm excited to see it, not because I think it's going to, you know, it's going to yield to something super great immediately or anything like that, but it may be a necessary first step to really getting rid of the deep rot that is well, well, well below the surface.
The promise comes pre-broken, though, right? Like, when we unwrap this promise on, you know, inauguration morning, yeah, it is already in pieces in the box. And I just, you know, that,
yeah,
I
am, but it's going to be like that. Important. It's not going to be like, you know, there's, I don't think the messenger of this, or the, you know, the sword of this is ever going to be a person we're like, oh yeah, that it's exactly who we wanted. It's a Disney hero. It's always going to be a kind of warped, you know, minion. To
I just
mix,
don't think
magisteria there.
I just don't think this is a perfect is the enemy of the good situation. This is a, not good. it's not going to happen. And I agree that it would be great if we had someone who did the things on Kash Patel's list that we like, checking the surveillance state, checking the unelected bureaucrats, dismantling some or all of the FBI's wild overreach. Instead, I think that we will see politically motivated persecutions and prosecutions just like his predecessor.
It's hard
right.
to imagine.
So then the choice is really between maintaining the status quo or doing something different. I'm ready to try something different.
I mean, this is the problem, though, is that if that's the choice, it's a bad choice, because the status quo has serious problems for sure. But someone like Kash Patel also has serious problems. He is a scammy lackey. We haven't even talked about his Kash branded scarves and wine. $240 for a six pack. Sounds like a
Who's
great
making
deal.
You
buy right?
Again,
Who's
I making thought you buy? This was
sure,
America.
Okay. Great. But yeah. this is what kind of a guy he is. Is not somebody who has a real ideological kind of policy driven project. He is not somebody that anybody thinks is like he shows up at the FBI to do a specific thing. He shows up at the FBI to defend Trump. And he views these policies that we've talked about, declassification, sort of targeting, you know, the deep state. However, like that, his goal isn't to do good, solid FBI reform. His goal is to defend Trump whatever it takes. And that is the problem with someone like that. He is not going to root out the rot in the FBI. He's going to and leave us with a new and different kind of Trumpier rot. And it, I don't think that there is a whole lot of upside here. I think that we are going to end up with somebody who's not a reformer, who just ends up replacing one type of very familiar rot with a new and unfamiliar type of rot that is just about loyalty to Donald Trump.
When the Berlin Wall came down, it did not fix anything in Eastern Europe, but it made change possible. And I have all of the fears, you know, that Peter and Catherine have articulated, and probably some, you know, some extra just for me. And yet this is a possibility to change the status quo. And the status quo is bad and untenable. I think in other places, like what I worry about is, you know, somebody like Kennedy at HHS, is he actually going to spend more time chasing down color, you know, color dyes in Twinkies? And disrupting scientific research and things like that. That is a real possibility. But it's also like even that would be better than a status quo, which has just been shown to be terrible and awful. And you have at places like Jim O'Neill has been named as a deputy at HHS. He is somebody who's connected to Peter Thiel. He has run a bunch of companies and firms where I think he will actually be in a very positive and powerful position within HHS, and he will start to reform that in ways that I think we'll all agree would be good. But, you know, you got to take the good and the bad. And right now, it's also like, what is the alternative? That Kash Patel get taken out, you know, he gets removed, and Christopher Wray just sticks around for another 3 years? Like, you know, we got to live in the world we're in.
Certainly, you know, Peter, you were saying about how he's not someone who has sort of like a coherent ideological agenda or philosophical agenda. Certainly, it is the case that a lot of people who can be described as having coherent philosophical, ideological, whatever, pragmatic agendas are the same people who did all the lying that we were talking about in the previous segment. And maybe it's good for them to take a time out. I would also point on the Nick side of the ledger here that regardless of overall shape, efficacy, propriety of some of these picks, including Kash Patel, I think that the potential for there to be versions of the Twitter files and Facebook files coming out of government, the FBI files, you know, declassifying the JFK thing once and for all, which Kash Patel is very interested in, talking about over and over again, and doing that at the CDC and like unraveling all the various missteps that were done during the pandemic. I think that possibility is real, and it's actually helpful to have Elon Musk kind of being Flavor Flav over in the corner with his experience of actually doing the Twitter files. Like, that kind of changed the way that we understand and think about government pressure on social media companies. If we could do that from within the government and start seeing what government has done, I think that could be welcome. And the deep state in this case really, therefore, is the CIA and the NSA. It's the unaccountable, not even on the budget, really, security forces. And anytime you have that kind of concentrated absolute power, it's going to be corrupted absolutely. So, yes, I don't like children's book authors and supplement salesmen to be the tip of any spear at all. But if I'm looking forward to any like upside of all of this, it is precisely that. It's let's declassify some shiz. Okay, that's a preview, by the way, for later on. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors over at the University of Chicago. Friends, in an election year, it's too easy to get lost in the fog of news and opinion. Understanding the real life impact of political events can be a challenge in these even numbered years. So we've got a podcast that we would like to recommend to you called Not Another Politics Podcasts. You see what they did there? Brought to you by the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Not Another Politics Podcast provides clear research-driven perspectives on the biggest issue of the day, issues even. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. You can subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Again, that's harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Or just look for Not Another Politics Podcast wherever you acquire such product. Do it today. You'll be glad to date, you know, at the end of the thing over there in the corner. Reminder going forward that we have a special bonus webathon episode, which is just going to be all your questions. So this is the time where we answer several questions from the same person, for example, or, you know, again, as individuals, as a group, can be more thumb sucky, can be less thumb sucky, whatever. Go for it. Send them all to roundtable@reason.com, but do it now because it's Webathon week and we're going to tape that on Wednesday. So there's not a lot of time. I want a whole bunch of emails in the inbox. So this question comes from Matthew Humphrey, who asks, you've probably gotten several of these, so I'll try to keep it short. It seems like the new assisted suicide bill in the UK is rich territory for the discussion of the libertarian perspective on this issue. While on the surface, it seems like the ultimate libertarian cause, its legalization coinciding with socialized healthcare seems rife with decidedly un-libertarian possibilities. I think it also brings up the true challenge of libertarian causes within a state that is already not broadly libertarian, similar to the contradiction of opening the borders of a state that has a generous welfare program. Just open that can of worms at the end of that email. Nicely done there, Matthew Humphrey. Catherine, you're the editor of Reason.
Yeah, I like the French goodbye on that email. It was like, also.
Yeah.
What about this?
We call that a freedom goodbye since 9/11, by the way.
Goodbye. So I think specifically we're going to end up talking about a British goodbye here.
That's actually good.
I think that assisted suicide is, to me, a sort of signature libertarian issue. I think that is a right that people have should be respected by the state. I think that it's gone pretty badly in Canada, and this is a fair question. So I would love to see a world in which, and I can think of many, many mechanisms whereby people could indicate their sincere desire for help to end their own lives that would protect the people who offered that help from legal consequences. And I think that Canada going around sending emails to everyone that has to wait a really long time for a psychiatric appointment saying, have you considered killing yourself, is probably not good. This is a problem with socialized medicine, not a problem with the concept of assisted suicide. And as I have said, with respect to the immigration stuff, two wrongs don't make a right. So, yeah, it's a bummer that we screwed up our entitlement state. It's a bummer that it is enormous and overweening and trickles into every single aspect of our lives. That does not give us an excuse to violate people's fundamental rights, either to free movement or to end their own lives.
Peter, you did Obamacare. Does this make sense to have assisted suicide legal in a place that has Obamacare?
In a place that has Obamacare, like the United Kingdom. They don't have that there. They got a different one. It's called the NHS, the National Health Service. There was a whole Danny Boyle-directed Olympics show about it. This is a thing that you have to start. If you're going to talk about the UK healthcare system, you have to start from the premise, like in the understanding that they are obsessed with it. It's like football and hamburgers for them. It's a like something that is deeply embedded in their national psyche and sense of who they are as British people. And that's despite the fact that the NHS has had really serious problems for the last several years, including like just major issues with ambulance drivers and delays, strikes and threatened strikes amongst the workers, and just like a whole bunch of reports saying that the UK is actually like it's just the UK healthcare system is just has real problems, especially with people who have serious diseases like cancer. So you have to start from there, and then you bring this in. And once you have legalized assisted suicide through this system, then even though, yes, the way the law is written is that it's supposed to be somebody only for people who have less than 6 months to live, they have to have a doctor sign off on this, there's a whole process, they have to administer the drugs themselves. Okay, this sounds like it's pretty straightforward and like is just going to give people who are already dying an option to end it sooner and to end the pain. But in practice, I think what we have seen in Canada is that that is not always what happens. And what happens is that there are pressure campaigns, at least at the margins, at least implicitly, on people who are cost centers for socialized medicine. Because people who are dying but not yet dead are very expensive to take care of. And when that expense is borne by taxpayers through a socialized healthcare system, then the incentives line up for the state to say, hey, you know what? Maybe it would just be easier for all of us if you weren't around. And I worry about that. I worry about that quite a bit. And so I think there is a slippery slope here. And I think there are some pretty worrying incentives in place anytime you have legislation like this in the context of a national healthcare system where taxpayers foot the bill.
Nick, you've been in libertarian circles for quite some time.
I have been near death for many years now.
I've been trying to incept it, but it didn't quite take. This has been a cause for a long time in libertarian circles. Do you think that the way that it's rolled out has given us all reason to kind of pause about
I don't think so. And especially in the American version, I'm sure we'll be told that if you like your end of life death angel, you'll be able to keep your end of life death angel. You know, just to be in the great tradition of previous expansions of the medical surveillance state. I think first go back to the real question. Do you have a right to exit when you want to, especially if you are dead, you know, you're in pain, you're going to die really soon. And you may not be fully capable of committing suicide because of a debilitating disease. If you have MS or Lou Gehrig's disease or something like that, we should be emphatic in saying that, yes, people have a right to end their life when they see fit. And then I do think that there are there's a serious need to put safeguards around that to make sure that people aren't being squeezed out. But, you know, even going back to movies like It's a Wonderful Life, at one point, you know, Mr. Potter tells George Bailey, you're worth more dead than alive. And, you know, there's some people at a certain point in their life, especially if you were able to help your heirs or the causes that you care about, and you are 6 months from the end of your life because you have terminal cancer or some other kind of unspeakable pain, you know, why not be able to, you know, to follow through on the ultimate act, which, you know, as Camus always told us, you know, the essential question every day of human existence is, are you going to commit suicide or not? I think we need to keep that front and center and then work out from there to make sure the guardrails are okay. The reports from Canada are more mixed. I mean, there are a lot of people who still believe, you know, that suicide is not simply a crime, but is a sin. And the Canadian experience is not great. Canada also has a much more overwhelming national healthcare state where people really are put on long lines and people really, you know, the government funds all the healthcare or virtually all the healthcare in a way that they don't in Britain. And we need to, you know, look at that, learn from that and move away from that. But generally speaking, I think, you know, the right to assistance in suicide is something that is a good thing that we should figure out how to do well, not start to say, well, you know, until everybody is self-insured, you know, we really can't even talk about this because bad stuff's going to creep in. And it's happening anyway, by the way. That's the other thing.
Yeah, you know,
it's happening anyway. And like, how do you make sure that the people who are doing this because they deeply love and care for somebody and are doing, you know, their will, are trying to do their will just as much as they are trying to, you know, meet all the terms of somebody's estate, you know, after death. How do we make sure that they are not going to get screwed over because, you know, they help, you know, their loved one exit on their own terms?
I have mentioned this before, usually in the context of what's your most non-libertarian position, or although you can fill a whole book with mine probably, but I'm very conflicted on this issue. I have been persuaded by the argument of Tucker Carlson, actually, that it's not a good idea to give doctors in particular this this tool in the box, that it's just it's in contradiction to the Hippocratic Oath, that there should be a way for people to do this without involving a doctor or a nurse, is kind of my bad munchy middle position on this, which is not fixed in any way, shape or form. I just feel like if you give the state and if you give doctors this as a possibility, the bad things can tumble forth from it. But that's not a satisfying answer to anybody. Let's get actually to our, and we'll table the previous concept of debanking that was in our preparation in the interest of time, but it's a good topic to get into for perhaps next week. Mark Andreessen has been talking about this, and Zach Weissmuller and others at Reason have been
and Melania
talking
Trump.
About this for, and Melania Trump has been talking about this for years.
Yep.
And Barron still likes his suitcase after all this time. But instead, let's pivot to our end of podcast, what we've been consuming, since at least three of us consume the same thing, which is kind of gross. I want to secede from my life now. Speaking of the previous segment, Nick, why don't you lead us off in a discussion?
Well, I'm going to say we helped kill someone this past weekend. Right? That's what you're talking about, Matt? Three of us helped kill the same person this weekend?
This is like a Murder on the Orient Express kind of situation here.
We're moving into Murders Only in the Building territory now, that the podcast in 2025 is taking a dramatic and comedic turn.
Tell us, Nick, how much you loved going to the movie theaters and watching Wicked.
Yeah, I watched Wicked, the you know, the big movie version of the hit Broadway musical, which itself was based on a 1995 novel, which has one of the best conceits possible, always where you take a character and give them, you tell their backstory that reframes the entire story. I think most people know that Wicked is about how the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz got that way and why maybe she's not so bad after all. The musical originally was staged in 2003, and the movie is the, I will say this just as a prologue, that the interviews and all of the material promoting the movie is just the worst kind of, like, if Kamala Harris had won, we would be living in a world where it would just be an endless procession of, like, kind of Hunger Games, Capital District weirdos talking endlessly about themselves in ways that are boring and offensive. The movie itself, the musical is good. The movie is very good. And I want to throw in a libertarian theme to it without giving any spoiler alert. So it's very complicated, but the whole point, you know, and the whole thing about The Wizard of Oz, you know, both the original movie and the novels and certainly Wicked, is that, you know, The Wizard of Oz is a bullshit artist. And that when you get behind the scenes, you realize that there are idiots running everything and they may or may not be malevolent a little bit. And that's what you find here. And as I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, my God, this play came out in 2003. It is a critique of the Bush administration and its foreign policy and its push for the Patriot Act and a national surveillance state that would be carried out by flying monkeys. And if you, when you see the movie, and you know, this is one of the most popular movies along with Gladiator 2 that Peter and I talked about a week ago, which also I think has some wonderful insights into our current political moment. Wicked is profitably read as a critique of the national surveillance state as it was kicked off after 9/11. Highly enjoyable movie, and I liked it a lot.
If we give the flying monkeys to Kash Patel, everything will be okay because he will free them. That's where we are now.
This is where it becomes complicated because, you know, you come in and you say, I'm going to free the flying monkeys. And then you're like, wait, you're telling me I can use these flying monkeys, you know, to sell my children's novels? I could carry them everywhere? Yeah. You know, so.
I just hope they get drunk on his cash wine.
Yeah. No, it's too expensive. He'll keep that. He'll give them cheap stuff.
Peter, what did you think about this?
I'm pretty sure that wine is the cheap stuff. So Nick last week framed Gladiator 2 as the first movie of the next Trump administration. And I think he's right to sort of call out this film as a remnant of like what we would have gotten with Kamala Harris. It is definitely the last film of the Biden administration. And it is so, so, so not for me.
It's all about you.
Well, yeah. It is because I was the one watching it, and now I'm the one talking about it.
Who made you? Who made you go in? You know, RFK Jr.
Just ignore him. Keep going.
The actual person who made me watch this, his name is Sonny Bunch, and he works for the Bulwark, and you can blame him.
Gross.
So, no, this is. I don't even know how to process this movie in some ways because in some way I do think that it is. There is a way in which it is technically competent and it delivers on its promise. But I also found this movie smug and irritating and self-satisfied and just kind of ugly to look at. This is a movie that is fundamentally a big, epic, expensive fantasy film. And they bragged in advance about how much of the sets and the props they had made in real life rather than, you know, using computer graphics. And it just looks flat, digital, and ugly all throughout. There is not one shot or one scene in this movie that provokes real awe. And that is a big contrast to the original Wizard of Oz film, you know, from the golden age of cinema, which to this day is beautiful and epic. And as a kid, I watched that movie over and over again. And even though it was already decades old and way out of date, it provoked awe constantly. And the characters, a big part of it was that it showed how magical and mysterious and and sort of and wonderful the world of Oz was, not just to the viewers, but to the characters themselves, who had this sense of magic and mystery living in the world around them. And this movie just absolutely lacks any of that. It is a fantasy film that is as unfantastic as I can imagine. And I just found it grating and unpleasant to watch.
I agree with both of you. except for the, I thought the sets were nice and the costumes were nice. I was spending more time watching that than watching them try to drag another 7 minutes out of the same single song that was profitably finished 7 minutes before. Interesting, super irritating politics, in many ways. And if I see Bowen Yang, even on the street, I might assault him. He's the least funny human person I've ever seen.
Matt's having his own masculinity crisis. Why is he so threatening?
I am. No, it's his glasses. I can't do it.
He's supposed to be a dick. The people at the college or, you know, the university are assholes.
I'm an adult. It's still very irritating to watch him do that. But I'm not talking about my pick. Catherine's talking about hers.
You know, I was going to talk about the fact that I went to the Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Natural History in New York because it's pretty freaking great. But I unfortunately have been forced to pivot and talk about the Camus instead because Nick mentioned Camus earlier.
Don't you mean Camus?
Okay. Yeah, I do. And I, too, consumed a retelling of a classic tale through a new lens. I read The Meursault Investigation, which is the 2013 novel by the Algerian journalist Kamel Daoud. It's the retelling of The Stranger from the eye through the kind of, or not a retelling, an analysis of, an interrogation of The Stranger from the perspective of the unnamed Arab that the protagonist in The Stranger kills. Wow. I didn't enjoy it at all. I read it for book club. And the reason that it's not good in part is because it forced, I think, an extremely 2013 kind of political DEI-ish post-colonialist framework on a book that really hates everyone equally. I think if there's one thing you can say about The Stranger, it's like, not just the Arabs and the women are unpersoned, but in fact, all people are unpersoned. That's the whole deal of the book. So I, too, am alternately grumpy and somewhat impressed with the artistry of a highly politicized retelling, The Meursault Investigation.
So your position is that there should be more unpersoning?
That seems to be Camus' position, or at least the position of...
Or that private police forces either would have protected the unnamed Arab or revenged the unnamed Arab.
I guess what I'm saying is I wish I had gone to see Wicked.
Yeah. I will be excited to hear what you have to say about it, because unlike Catherine, our two grumpy friends, you know, this is a movie that obviously is taking place after The Wizard of Oz. It's got heavy influences from things like Harry Potter and The Hunger Games, and it plays with that. And
I thought you were going to give me a hit me with a Catherine, you're a lady, but
no, I would never. I would never. I don't see gender
like as in The Stranger.
So you're
will unperson me regardless.
Yes. So like the witch, you're green with envy. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So I saw some gender in my pick, which is The Return of the King, The Fall and Rise of Elvis Presley. And the gender is Elvis, and Elvis is awesome. That is basically... I was thinking about
Is that one of the 23 genders you can pick out on the census
it's
or Facebook or whatever?
It's the only one that matters, I think
Elvis it's only pretty potent.
My pronouns are I, me, mine, and Elvis, just like Mojo Nixon. It's the Netflix documentary, fresh out, does the thing that Nick and I always talk about, which is obviously Priscilla Presley, who was the executive producer and cooperator, so that's going to have a little bit of the sharper, more rancid edges dulled off. I know that doesn't make any sense. But it's all about his famed comeback special on, I think it was NBC, network television special that came out in 1968. He hadn't performed live in 7 years, which is insane. He'd been made like 30 really bad movies. They start out okay, but then they got really bad. Sort of a known historical tale, and then he comes out, and it's 68, and he's got his old band back, and Scotty Moore and whatnot, and he's looking mighty fine in his black leather. He's lost a bunch of weight, but he's also very nervous. And what does it all mean? Does he still have it? The world has passed him by. What's it going to be like? And what it's like is it's super awesome. Just awesome. About that. It's sort of like where it fits in his career. And then it kind of ends with some of the performances of it. And the shocker to me, besides just watch, I hadn't watched the whole special before, and they don't show the whole special, just bits from it. And that's, you know, really great. But the Talking Heads, probably the person who is the MVP of it is Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins,
which
is not someone I like care about in any way, shape, or form. Not a fan, although I kind of appreciate him as a character. But like his descriptions of the awesomeness of Elvis and the horrid way in which his talent was kind of throttled for those years, it's just wonderful. Like, he gets the thing so well. It's a marvelous depiction of one of the greatest artists doing his artistry, and I will always be there for that. And it doesn't matter who or when. And so if you like Elvis in any way, go there and watch it, even though it might not like tell you the deepest, darkest secrets about everything. But that's really not the case. It reminds me of the Oasis documentary that came out a couple of years ago that just sort of was a build up to their gigantic concert in front of 300,000 people. It didn't necessarily have to show you The Fall that came afterwards. It was like getting to this pinnacle and then the pinnacle story. And that's a nice way to end sometimes. And I think a lot of
Elvis, though, had a great last act. I mean, you know, obviously
sure.
It ends sadly, you know, his final years, he recorded a ton of really good music, especially right after.
Really good
that.
Music.
Yeah.
What this one highlights is that just before, like his, and I didn't really fully internalize this, or I've forgotten it, that just before the comeback special, he starts to reclaim his artistry by recording a gospel record. And like the moment how that kind of re-galvanized him is pretty interestingly depicted. Anyways, that's all the depictions we have time for. Go see it. It's pretty good. We are doing a webathon, as mentioned before. We'll mention it one last time here. Go to the website on Tuesday morning. Read Catherine's initial post mentioning this. Hit reason.com/donate or /webathon. I think both work. Mash until your fingers bleed. But also, very importantly, just send us emails. Roundtable@reason.com. Do that. We also have events. I've mentioned previously the inaugural Reason Versus. Peter, do you want to tell us again about that real quick, like?
Yeah, we're starting a debate series called Reason Versus. It pits reason versus other publications on big issues that divide us. The first edition is going to feature Reason Versus The Bulwark. We'll be debating the proposition you don't have to pick a side in politics. Matt and Nick from this podcast are going to be representing Reason. Tim Miller and Sarah Longwell will represent The Bulwark. I'm going to be moderating. We're going to talk about partisanship, about voting, about what it means to pick sides in political debates. This is going to happen on the evening of Wednesday, December 18th at the Howard Theater here in Washington, D.C. You can buy tickets now at reason.com/events. It's Wednesday, December 18th at the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C. Reason Versus. It's going to be a great time.
Awesome. We will catch you back through our special webathon bonus episode coming soon. And until then, have a happy holly jolly webathon, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye. Forever.